Hello and welcome to Mothers of Invention, our new podcast series where we're celebrating the fact that although climate change is most definitely a man-made problem,
it has a wonderfully feminist solution.
I'm Maeve Higgins. I'm a comedian and I live in New York. When I'm not here doing the podcast, I write for the New York Times all about my opinions.
And I'm Mary Robinson. And when Maeve was 8 years old, I became the first female president of Ireland. Now, after decades of global politics, I've turned my access to the corridors of power around the world to my advantage as a climate justice activist.
So in each episode, we're going to entertain you with the outrageous stories of the Khaleesis of climate change all over the world. And we'll hear their genuinely incredible stories.
And that's because women are disproportionately affected by climate change. They've had to come up with the answers at every stage, whether they're engineers, chefs, farmers, housewives, or artists. And if they've found an ingenious way to help us save the planet,
we're going to crown them a mother of invention. This week, we're talking about a subject that's close to everyone's heart because it's in their stomach, and that is food. We're going to meet an eco-feminist who set up India's biggest seed bank.
We are the ones who work to maintain life. We rejuvenate the soil, the water, the biodiversity. That's where the seed saving really started.
And we'll be joined by another woman who has come up with a step-by-step recipe to actually reverse climate change.
Our mission is about mapping, measuring, modeling, and communicating the toolbox of solutions to actually reverse global warming.
And we'll hear from women in Nigeria who've taken the Tupperware party concept and turned it into an act of environmental activism.
I must be able to identify women who are enterprising, who are risk takers to be spreading clean energy gospel.
But first, we're going to have to be really honest with ourselves.
Oh, I don't like the sound of this, Maeve. Where are we going with this?
Well, I found myself doing this recently, Mary. I was on a film set and one of the ADs called out like, OK, who's for lunch? Who's vegetarian? And I said, I am, even though I'm not a vegetarian. But I wanted people to think I was a vegetarian. So I realised I'm kind of an aspirational vegetarian because I sense that that's the right thing to do.
That's two of us. I'm an aspirational vegetarian too, in the sense that I am trying.
Oh, you are?
I actually have cut out red meat almost completely. Now, if I'm faced with lamb from the west of Ireland, my potential...
It's so delicious. I know. I hope we don't have any lambs from the west of Ireland listening. They'll be quaking in their little boots. So neither of us are fully vegetarian, but I think lots of our listeners agree that from a climate change perspective, meat is enemy number one when it comes to climate change. Is that true?
Well, actually, Maeve, rather than naming problems, I'd rather talk solutions. And this is a good place to introduce you to a woman whose work I've admired for quite some time now. This mother of invention has written a manifesto, a recipe for reversing global warming, if you will. The Drawdown was a New York Times bestseller. It's been a massive inspiration to me personally because it's reversing the problems that we've caused. And her name is, and welcome to, Catherine Wilkinson.
Oh, hello, Catherine.
Mary and Maeve, thank you. I'm over the moon to be with you all.
Well, it's great to hear your voice again, Catherine. We have the book here in front of us. It's a big tome. Would you give us a quick summary of the Drawdown project?
I think the easiest thing is to think about Drawdown as the point in time when the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere peaks and then begins to decline on a year-to-year basis. So it's basically a threshold at which society heads back to conditions that are most conducive for life on this planet. I think it's sort of the most common sense climate goal for humanity. The nonprofit Project Drawdown, which is led by Paul Hawken, is a growing coalition of folks from around the world who are committed to making that goal real. Our mission is about mapping, measuring, modeling, and communicating really the toolbox of solutions to actually reach drawdown and reverse global warming. We had about 65 research fellows from six continents who worked on the project and over 100 advisors from around the world who contributed to the book Drawdown. The book really presents humanity's collective wisdom about the 100 technologies and practices most impactful for getting us to draw down. And most of them are solutions actually that we already have in hand.
I was looking at your website too, and you rank the solutions in order of importance. And just before we got on the phone to you, we were talking about sort of the problems and meat being one of them. But what do you think is the number one solution?
The official number one, I'm sorry to say, isn't very sexy. It's focused on refrigerant chemicals, hydrofluorocarbons. But there's a more hidden number one, which is split between educating girls and family planning. These are really about closing the gap on access to universal education and to high-quality, voluntary, reproductive health care, which are fundamental rights and opportunities for women and girls. But they're also key factors for whether we will end up at the United Nations medium population projection for 2050 or the high population projection. So when you take those two together, educating girls and family planning, it turns out that advancing gender equity is actually the number one solution to address global warming. But what we found in Drawdown that is just so fascinating is that the food sector is the largest sector for potential impact overall. It's 8 of the top 20 solutions, which is just not how we think about climate change. It's not how we talk about climate change.
Very like Mary, you're a solution-focused person. So what does the Drawdown have to say about how we respond to our food and what our food is doing to the environment?
So we look at what we produce and how we produce it, as well as the issue of waste. The way that I like to think about it, we hear this term decarbonize all the time. Sure, we want to decarbonize the energy sector, but we actually want to recarbonize agriculture. We want to use agricultural practices that bring carbon back home to earth. There are specific farming practices which have come to be called regenerative agriculture because it's about really incredible practices. And a lot of them are things that human beings have known how to do for many, many moons. We just need to bring them back at scale and shift away from these ideas of heavy mechanization and heavy inputs of chemicals from the outside.
What do you think about meat? I know that's another part of the Drawdown project.
Yeah, it is. You're talking to a 2-decades-long vegetarian, so this is near and dear to my heart.
What age were you when you became a vegetarian?
I was 16, a very idealistic and committed 16-year-old.
Yeah.
I learned at that time about this environmental impact of meat production, and ruminants, I hate to say, are the most prolific offenders because they produce so much methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas, about 30 times as powerful at heat trapping as carbon dioxide.
Ruminants being cows?
Cows, sheep, animals that have a rumen to help with their digestive process. So actually, if all cows were in their own nation, they would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases after China and the U.S.
We mustn't let them get their own nation.
We mustn't let them.
We have to stop them from organizing.
Probably for a lot of reasons.
Maeve, we want some intelligent solutions, please. Catherine, continue.
Yeah, but it's actually everything that we eat and how we produce it that matters.
Now, Maeve, I take it you're familiar with the term tree hugger because you're going to meet a tree hugger. I've known her for quite a long number of years. She is incredible.
I've definitely heard of it. I used to hear about it in kind of a derisive way. So I'd love to know where it comes from.
Well, it comes from a group of women in the Himalayas in the 70s who hugged the trees in their forests in order to stop them being felled. It was a movement called CHIPKO. And one woman gave those poor, mostly illiterate women a voice and helped spread the word globally. And it did stop the deforestation. Her name was Vandana Shiva. I've met her quite a number of years ago. She's now a Dr. Shiva. She has a PhD. She's a scientist as well as being somebody who can talk to women farmers in their own language. And I'd like us to talk to her because that was her first piece of environmental activism and she hasn't stopped since then.
Wow.
That was many years ago.
Wow. So what's she been doing?
In fact, she spent the last 30 years creating India's biggest seed bank and a massive eco-feminist movement in India, which has spread across the continent. So Hello, Vardana. Are you there?
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Hi, Vardana. Hi, Vandana. Very, very nice to know that you're one of our mothers of invention.
Could you talk about how you got started and when it first occurred to you that this was the work you needed to do?
I got started really with a dream to be a physicist. You know, Einstein was my inspiration. And I followed that dream, even though I went to schools that didn't have physics. I did a PhD in the foundations of quantum theory. But when I was leaving for Canada to do my PhD, I went to visit my favorite forests and rivers, and I found the forest was gone and the stream was a trickle. That's when I started to talk to the communities locally in the Himalaya where I come from. I come from central Himalaya where the Ganges comes down into the plains. And they said, oh, but now there's hope to stop this deforestation because the movement called CHIPCO has started. CHIPCO means to hug. So while I was going for my PhD, I took a pledge in my mind, every vacation of mine would be given to be a volunteer for the women of CHIPCO. That's how I ended up being part of the movement for hugging trees. And it is really for me the place where I learned how to be very strong in your resistance, very creative in your resistance, based on deep love, so much love that you hug a tree.
Just beautiful to hear the origins of that story that then grew into your network called Navdanya, which is seed keepers and producers spread across 22 states in India. Can you talk about where you're at with that now?
When I wanted to start saving seeds, where do I go? I don't go to Delhi, the capital, which is a polluted city. I go to the villages of CHIPCO, where I had worked with the women to defend the forest. And I didn't know anything about agriculture, but I used to pick up books from my parents' library, go to the villages and say, do you have this plant? Do you have this seed? Do you have this crop? And the men would very arrogantly say, oh, we don't grow all this anymore. We grow potato because that sells. Or we grow soybean because it's a cash crop. And I'd continue to sit and have a little chai with the women. And they say, I have the seeds because that's what really feeds the family. These fellows only know how to drink alcohol, play cards, and gossip. We are the ones who work to maintain life. That's where the seed saving really started. So we are creating local sovereignty groups that have seed in their hands, that are able to grow their food with their knowledge, that are able to distribute it locally with the Ilabhat 100-kilometer idea. And we rejuvenate the soil, the water, the biodiversity. We even rejuvenate climate stability. And we bring back women's central role in being seed keepers and running the food economy on an intelligent basis with life on Earth.
When it comes to the actual practical on-the-ground details, could you describe how your seed bank works and how they're resistant to the effects of climate change like drought and flood?
Basically, the seed banks were based on reclaiming the commons, saving and collecting every seed, not with an anthropocentric and patriarchal bias of this seed is commercially useful, but with the recognition that our mothers had been mothers of invention and we can be mothers of invention today by respecting the continuity of that invention, that neither nature nor our mothers evolved a seed that was totally useless. For example, 200,000 rice varieties that the tribal peasants evolved. We're working in the center of genetic diversity where rice evolved in India, in Orissa and Chhattisgarh. So we collect the seeds, save the seeds. Then we create a community seed bank, which is both a physical space for saving seeds, making sure it's not damaged by pests and rain and moisture, but also it is the relationship of exchange that includes the seed bank. When any farmer wants a particular kind of seed, for example, in central India, there was a terrible drought. And farmers came to us and we need this year drought-tolerant seeds. We have them in the seed bank. We also have seed keepers who maintain living seed banks in their fields so that we have larger quantities of climate-resilient seeds in these times of climate change. And when there's a need, it's available in the commons, and we continue to use the ancient system of exchange that when you take seed, you give back 1 1/4 when you're able to.
Do you have any advice for our listeners that are in countries like here in America or in Ireland or England from female farmers and scientists in India and in Africa where you've studied and worked?
I think one thing we have to remember, we've been told the biggest lie of the century, that without chemicals, we will all starve. 50% of all greenhouse gases are coming from an industrial globalized food system. And 100% solution can lie in regenerating our forests, rejuvenating farms with more biodiversity, and making our soils organic. Calculations are there. 2 tons per hectare of organic matter can get rid of the 10 gigaton gap that is still there in spite of the Paris Agreement. A very important issue is the British, you know, when you're colonized, you're always being improved. And when the British colonized us, they wanted to improve us. Well, when the British sent Sir Albert Howard to India to improve Indian farming, he was a good enough scientist to recognize that the fields were fertile, the pests were not damaging the crops, and he said, I will make the pest and the peasant of India my professor in how to do good agriculture. The result of his studying under the pests and the peasant was a book called The Agricultural Testament. This book inspired the Soil Association in the UK, and it inspired the Rodale Institute in the United States, which is what became the organic food movement.
So for me, living in a city here, do you think it's worth my while trying to grow something of my own on my fire escape? Or do you think I should sort of stay shopping from things that are within 100 miles or just buy organic?
I think first and foremost, as Earth citizens, we have a duty to grow what we can. Even if you're living in an apartment building and there's only one windowsill, adopt one plant, adopt one seed and grow it. When the Greek economy collapsed in 2008, I had gone there and the young people were saying, well, we've lost all our jobs, what do we do? And I just said, grow your food. And when I went back next time, there were entire young people growing food in balconies and sharing it with their entire community. A young man, Red Soil Not Oil, from Detroit, where I had said, be a soil builder. And he said, I was unemployed, nothing was happening. I started to be a soil builder. Now I supply my entire community with food. So that is a meaningful activity. It's a sovereign activity we should be engaged in. If you don't have any other possibility, create a community garden. We have to connect food growing communities with communities that have to eat. Everyone must eat. Knowing who grew your food and how you grew it, because otherwise the future is going to be so deadly and toxic. And 75% of the diseases today, the chronic diseases, are related to toxics in our food or nutritionally deficient food. We can solve the health problem, the climate problem, the poverty problem, the SDGs. Every bit of it can be met by putting women at the center of the solution.
I think you are a true mother of invention, no doubt about it.
Thank you so much for talking to us today. It was just brilliant to hear from you. And it was great to see two old friends reunited.
Thank you. And a big hug, Mary, a very warm and big hug.
And a big hug to you too, down the line. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So, Catherine, it'd be good to maybe talk about the role of female farmers all around the world and the power of soil.
I'd love to. Those are two topics that are so important. Women are growing most of the food around the world, particularly in lower income regions. And soil, I think, is finally starting to get some of the love it deserves. We all know about emitting carbon from burning fossil fuels, but we have also been emitting it from our soils as a result of how we've been farming. Our agricultural lands have actually lost 50 to 70% of their original carbon stock.
Yeah, I keep hearing about soil depletion.
That means that the quality of soil is getting lower or there's less soil?
Both. Soil's been eroding and blowing away and washing away, and the quality of it has been declining. What I learned when we were working on Drawdown is that healthy soil is full of carbon and full of life. So it's actually full of loads of microorganisms, like a billion of them in a teaspoon of healthy soil. They have this relationship with the plants that are growing. So as plants absorb carbon through photosynthesis, they exchange it with these microorganisms through their roots for other key nutrients. So there's this really, really important whole world of exchange that's happening in healthy soil.
So what type of farming has been causing this depletion of the soil?
The farms that we think of with big machinery and spraying lots of fertilizers and pesticides have created salination in lots of places from over-irrigation. What scientists have come to understand is that there's this whole microbial life of soil that's really important, in the same way that we've come to understand the importance of microbes in our guts.
Oh yeah, that's all my mother ever says. Whenever I'm feeling sick or feeling down or anything, she's just like, what's your microbes? It's your gut. That's what's happening to your brain.
Yeah, she's exactly. Exactly. I think we have to really learn what it is that soil likes. It doesn't like to be naked, for example. Soil really likes to have something growing in it, on it at all times, and having lots of different crops rotate through. We have to come to know what it is that soil loves and start to treat it in that way.
So Mary, we've heard lots about farming and food production and people producing their own crops to feed themselves. And that's really positive, you know, from a sustainability point of view. But it makes me think about the way we cook, our cooking processes. And if there's anything to be done there, like how are we cooking our food around the world? So I'm wondering what energy sources we use on a daily basis to feed ourselves and to feed families. Not everybody is just binging something in the microwave, I'm sure.
Exactly. And the drawdown. They ranked creating clean cookstoves at number 21 as the most impactful potential area for reversing climate change. With all this in mind, Maeve, we are heading to Nigeria. There's mothers of invention who may just have the answer to this catastrophe.
Solar sister entrepreneurs are like A1 ladies of solar power. A1 ladies would be selling lipsticks and eyeshadows through woman-to-woman networks. Solar sister entrepreneurs are selling something more powerfully related to beauty, light. My name is Neha Misra. I'm the co-founder and chief collaboration officer of Solar Sister. Solar Sister is a woman-led, woman-driven social enterprise. We work in the most underserved communities across Africa to make sure transformational, affordable technologies and clean energy access that the world has today don't just sit in urban centers. I am by training an economist, so in 2010, I decided that I was going to do my life's cost-benefit analysis. And I really asked myself, why am I here? What is my purpose? That, I would say, was the seeds of Solar Sister. We tap into solar energy, the largest source of renewable energy in the world. Women get access to world-class solar lights, mobile phone chargers, solar home systems, clean cooking technologies, which they use themselves and they sell to their communities.
My name is Blessing Ekane. I live in Uyo. I represent Solar Sister in Akwa Ibom State in Nigeria. My work is to recruit, train, and support women to be Solar Sister entrepreneurs, spreading clean energy gospel in our communities through direct sales of clean energy products like solar lamps, clean energy stoves, and just recently we added water filters. I didn't have a regular job, but I was into volunteering. Solar Sister was just coming into West Africa, concentrating in the north. So she approached and said, "Ah, no, it's somebody that can do this in Akwa Ibom State." And graciously, she just recommended because she knew I was kind of a smart person who could do this work. That's how I started the job. I must be able to identify women who are enterprising, women who are business-oriented, risk-takers. And you find them in all corners of the society, from families to friends to offices to schools.
Okay. That one is for three rooms.
When we started in Nigeria, one of the things that we heard again and again from the woman that we are working with was, you are selling solar lights, you are selling phone chargers, which are really helpful, but what can you do for the cooking related challenges that the woman face? women and girls are working in dark, smoky, dingy kitchens. There are more deaths from indoor air pollution because of solid fuel usage than number of deaths from malaria, HIV and AIDS combined.
In this region where we call the Niger Delta region, we have the atmosphere being polluted by the gaseous substances from the oil companies. And of course, the ones from the domestic homes, the firewood our people using cooking has contributed a large chunk of the pollution in the atmosphere. And that's the angle we try to tackle using our clean energy stoves. These stoves could mitigate against climate change.
The cook stoves that we sell are energy efficient firewood and charcoal stoves, which can reduce the amount of firewood that is needed. It can also reduce indoor air pollution substantially.
So when you use our stoves, you use less fuel, you buy less firewood or charcoal. It cooks faster. The children can actually be around, unlike when you have the other firewood. So it saves time, also time for cooking. It's clean, basically, and it's safer. Change is the only constant thing in life, but people usually resist it. So people feel, well, they've always been using this firewood stove. If you don't know the effect of what you're using, you're bound to resist a change that comes with it. With firewood, the heat generated is lost to the atmosphere because it's not insulating against heat loss. But there is this lookout technology we used to have, they call it the sawdust stove. They get an old paint can, stuff in sawdust, then pound and heat it such that it compacts. So I usually ask them, why do you need to pound and make the sawdust compact? They just said they don't know why. It's because the sawdust served as an insulator against heat loss. That's the technology that clean stoves have been built upon.
That's really what's at heart of Solar Sister, using women's social capital to help people adopt clean technologies. Since 2010, we have grown to more than 3,000 Solar Sister entrepreneurs, expanded in Nigeria, in Tanzania, and now we are looking at new countries where we would directly replicate Solar Sister. We have reached more than 1.3 million people with clean energy access so far, and we have just begun.
Being a solar sister, you need to be trained to be able to reorient people on why you should actually leave the old ways and embrace the new. Everyone has a role to play, from the littlest child to those in government. Everyone has a role to play, creating more awareness, keeping the environment clean. All of those impact on the society, on the environment in one way or the other.
I just love that story, Mary. I'm thrilled that we got to hear from those ladies and just to hear about the ripple effects by making small but really effective changes, you know.
Yeah, I think it's ideal when one solution has so many positive outcomes: financial emancipation, gender equality, personal security. And that's before you even get to improved mortality rates. It's win-win in so many ways for the community.
Mary and Catherine, I finally got around to watching this movie. It's on Netflix. It's called Cowspiracy, sort of like the inconvenient truth of food for lots of people. I learned about animal agriculture being responsible for so much greenhouse gas emissions, more than the combined exhaust from all transportation, which blew my mind. And I also learned about the meat lobby and special interest groups that have managed to silence lots of environmental groups and activists. So I don't know, it was just the terrible environmental impact of meat, but it's almost been whitewashed out because people are scared to come up against the power and resources of the meat industry, I suppose. Have you found that at all, Catherine?
So I think there's the meat industry. There's also the hesitancy to step on people's toes about what they like to eat. Like, for whatever reason, we're very happy to tell people not to fly and to ride their bikes and to change their light bulbs, but hands off the hamburger.
It can certainly cause some backlash in my country, in Ireland.
Oh, definitely. We're a big dairy farmers here.
It was interesting for me with Drawdown, being a very committed vegetarian, also to learn actually there are ways to raise livestock that have a net climate benefit. Peter Bick is an awesome filmmaker who has a recent short film called Soil Carbon Cowboys about how to raise cattle in a way that actually restores soil carbon. So there's hope for those who just can't give it all up.
Definitely. And I'm interested to see the impact of storytelling and media. And this particular film, Cowspiracy, between 2016 and 18, the number of vegans went from 500,000 to 3.5 million in the UK. And in the US, the figures are almost identical. They went from 1% to 6%. One of the producers of this show, Millie, she was recording at a vegan festival for another project that she was making. She said almost all the people there said that seeing a film was a turning point for them. Catherine, just playing devil's advocate, if I don't have a car and if I don't fly around the world and I don't eat meat and I buy organic, I can do all of that. But what if I have sort of an evil twin on the other side of the planet or just in the apartment next door who's doing the opposite, who's doing less than nothing?
I can't imagine you having an evil twin, Maeve. Clearly, it matters. And clearly, it will never be enough. If you really play out the logic of individual action, the best thing you could do, I'm sorry to say, is probably to die, which
Catherine.
Is like not, that's not very good.
That is the rudest thing Anya has ever said on a podcast.
You'll never have me back again. No, but it sort of points to the limitations of thinking about climate as something that can be solved just through individual action. The biggest impact we can have is through collective action and actually shifting systems.
Catherine, one of the lovely things about being able to talk to people like you as mothers of invention is we're talking as women about climate change. And for a long time, in my view, it was a world of scientists and melting icebergs and melting glaciers very far away. It didn't talk about people, about the impact at local level, about the need for solidarity. I would say the need to recognize the justice dimension, the need for love.
Isn't it refreshing, Mary?
Absolutely.
That the conversation is shifting. The lesson from the most successful social movements in history, I think, is that it always is about love. When we see moments of nonlinear social change and transformation, we need that secret sauce of the human spirit and the human heart, and somehow has taken a long time to make its way into the climate conversation. Still too often, we hear this kind of good guy, bad guy framework. We're going to fight climate change and slash emissions, and we're combating global warming. These metaphors reflect the ways of thinking that got us into this mess. And I think that women will be really critical to helping us to see that if climate change isn't the ultimate we're all in it together issue, I'm not sure what is. And maybe it's just that not everyone has quite realized that just yet.
Well, Pope Paul in his encyclical, which was Laudato Si, the byline was care for our common home. The only criticism I really would have was that he didn't really talk about the role of women. And I've actually had the opportunity to say that straight to his face, I'm glad to say.
Did you?
That's why I'm able to say it on air.
Yes. I hope that as more and more women are claiming their voices and using their voices, we see more and more of those voices being used for the planet.
And I'm so glad that you stuck it to the Pope. I can't believe you. That's the coolest thing I've ever heard. I bet you did it in such a great diplomatic way that he didn't even realize what was happening.
Actually, he responded very positively, I'm glad to say.
Well, Catherine, thanks for all of your great work on The Drawdown. It was wonderful to speak to you.
Yes, thank you, Catherine. It was absolutely great to hear you, and you definitely are a mother of invention.
Thank you so much, Mary and Maeve. This has been really fun, and I'm honored to be one of the family of the mothers of invention.
So there we are, Maeve, almost at the end of the first series of Mothers of Invention. I really don't dare to ask how it was for you. Did you learn anything, could I ask?
Yes, I'm loving it. You know, especially this food episode has really got me thinking about what I can do in my apartment in New York to be more responsible and also not to just like eat the same six things all the time. Anyway, you know what? I can't wait to see everybody again in 2 weeks' time with our final episode. That will appear in your stream straight from New York Climate Week. I think we're going to have a lot of fun, Mary.
I've no doubt about it, Mae, but please, please don't ask me again if you can come with me into the UN General Assembly. You can't. You
I
have no badge.
Just
you
say
understand.
That I'm your... Just say, tell them I'm your bodyguard. No, I understand.
You can find out more about the series, the mothers we've met today, and support them at mothersofinvention.online and follow us for updates and more episodes on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
If you want to support the podcast, you can do so through Kickstarter's Drip platform. We're in the initial stages, but we're on a serious mission, so your support and encouragement will really spur us along. To support on Drip, head to d.rip/mothersofinvention. Or follow the links on mothersofinvention.online. Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society and is made possible by the Compton Foundation and the Wallace Global Fund. Our series has been organically produced by Lena Prestwood, Research Zone and Code by Rain and Licorice, Aisha Yunus, Kim Jenna Durians, and carefully picked and packed by our editor, Samuel Shelton Robinson. This episode was mixed and processed by James McKee and the musical assets composed by Poddington Bear. Our theme music is Water Fountain by Tuneyards with kind permission from 4AD and Marriage Records. Our produce selectors and international story producers are
Wayna Udbang in Nigeria with editing support from Arlie Adlington.
Our head of markets is impact producer Hazel Falk.
Our head farmers and executive producers have been BD Finzi and Jess Search of Doc Society. Our senior consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King, Catherine Wilkinson and Suzanne Dalliwell.